Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 68, section 2. We got into the section a little ways. We're on old single column, page 765, and we're ready to start the fifth paragraph, paragraph number 5, right after the large paragraph break. There's the beginning of the section there. The paragraph that starts, "History is." Before we do that, though, as I mentioned as we were closing in the preceding session, that paragraph that the final paragraph that we read last time, the first half of it gives an important footnote to the stuff that we were engaging last session. And the second half of that paragraph really is a lead-in to what we're about to read in the rest of this section. So I'm going to go ahead and reread the second half of that fourth paragraph and bring out a couple of items that we didn't fully unpack last time to get us ready to engage the subsequent material here. So starting right in the middle there, where it says, "Two great influences." Two great influences which contributed to the early association of human beings were food hunger and sex love. These instinctive urges man shares with the animal world. Two other emotions which drove human beings together and held them together were vanity and fear, more particularly ghost fear. Now, we stressed last time that italicized held, that they were wanting to go beyond just those initial basic reactions of mind and functioning of the basal aspects of our mind that that tend to drive us together. They wanted us to also bring in those elements that that help to maintain what gets established. And so we'll be looking at that definitely. And then I wanted to point out they never miss an opportunity to throw in little tweaks of reflective potential. In that first clause, in that first sentence that I read about the two great influences, and they say food hunger and sex love. Now, they could have more precisely said, and sort of just factually said, food hunger and sex hunger. That's technically what we're talking about. But just note that they took the opportunity to not just merely say sex hunger, and it wasn't just because they didn't want to repeat the word hunger. They could have said food and sex hunger, right? They purposely threw in that alternative expression, sex love. Why? To remind you, just in passing, using it as an opportunity to remind you of the levels of meaning, right? And that technically, love is only on the sixth level of meaning, way up there on the genuine spiritual level, the ceiling, the upper domain in the hourglass analogy of our mindal self. That genuine level of religious consciousness, that level of genuine faith insight, etc. But we don't start there. We start as little children, and one of our first words is mine. Right? We start with most of our consciousness on the first level of meaning, on the level of the flesh. And, those basic flesh issues, like sex hunger. Okay. But we have rudimentary feelings and emotions tied to some of those foundational aspects of our mind, those foundational instincts. And, you know, it's those feelings that we initially identify this word love to. We take, you know, the word love comes down from the cosmos, you know, into our superconscious mind, trickles down, you know, and into a conscious thought, you know, that you begin to seek for some place to direct it. It's like, well, is that love? No, is that love? You know, oh, this. You know, and what do we pick? We know, you know, intuitively that it's something very profound, something that has a high degree of potential delight to it, you know, that sort of thing. And initially, you know, when all you have is those foundational things, you know, the most powerful things we experience is just that basic sex interaction phenomenon. And so that's where it starts, okay? But it's not technically love, but it's initially the only thing you can think of using the word love for. You know, and we all know many never really get much past that, and that's a one of the reasons why the revelators cringe at using the word L-O-V-E for what they want to use it for. Right, the sixth level of meaning fact. Sex love isn't literally love. It's just sex hunger, or you know, maybe you'd say lust. You know, you don't have to go to a sort of the amped up sense of the word lust, but just kind of a basic sense of the word lust. You know, it's just like saying brotherly love on the fourth level of meaning. Sex love on the first, brotherly love on the fourth. I mean, brotherly love isn't love. It's technically kindness. Just like sex love isn't technically love. Yeah. And you don't technically have love until you get up to the sixth level of meaning. But you start by moving it up. First, it's related, you know, to sex, and then you move it up to the second level of meaning. And, you know, it's just this, you know, very intense feeling that we have, you know, where you just decide love is a feeling, you know, to a degree transcended or divorced of immediate physicality, right, on the level of the flesh, but see, more abstractly, just a feeling, you know, and you just keep moving it up, you know, eventually you get to the fourth level of meaning, and you call that love, which is technically just kindness, right, you know, et cetera, you keep moving it up until finally you have that personal realization of divine fellowship on the sixth level of meaning that's genuine love. So just notice that, you know, that they, they're giving us this history, this evolution of civilization. In parallel, there's the development of selves, and you know, the concept of love starts out in the basement, and both, you know, in terms of the society and in the individuals. And so they're just reminding you of that by hoping that you don't just blow right past that and say, oh, yeah, that's the definition of love. You know, just pause and think about that a minute. If that's the definition of love, then how does that God is love thing work? That might be a little debased.
We still often relate to that love as mine.
And very selfish, right? You know, remember, technically, genuine love is transcendent of selflessness. I mean, it's so divorced from self that you can't even use the word self in a negating sense, selfless. It's transcendent of that. You know, if you're going to describe where it is, you can't use the word self at all, even in negation mode. It's that godlikeness level above. selflessness, where you have a genuine personal realizations. Both of those words, not as humans use them, but what they really mean, personal realization of divine fellowship. Not to mention divine is, is technically just deity likeness, right? Not God likeness. But you do personal realization, there's the personal. Right? You're personalizing that deity likeness. Rather than its personalization invading your mind and possessing you, right? It's being possessed by even that personality that we call God. You're being engaged by deity, and it's up to you if there's any personalization of that deity influence. That's your sovereign domain. That's your free will.
It's one of those things you only get to keep by giving it away.
Yeah, and then obviously the whole point in engaging that genuine love is to join the circuit, right? You don't just grab a hold of it and bury it on the sixth level of meaning and wait for the master to return, right? Let it be an inner source that flows down the levels of meaning and out into the external world and completing the circuit. Right? You become part of the encirclement of that functioning phenomenon. Okay, so anyway, that was... that gets us spun up again. And so just notice, I won't, always point it out, just notice if they throw in the word love again occasionally instead of saying sex hunger or something like that, more technical. They're just reminding you again of where everyone starts with L-O-V-E, the level of the flesh. All right, so what do they say as we get into paragraph 5 here?
Section 2, Factors in Social Progression, paragraph 5. History is but the record of man's age-long food struggle. Primitive man only thought when he was hungry. Food saving was his first self-denial, self-discipline. With the growth of society, food hunger ceased to be the only incentive for mutual association. Numerous other sorts of hunger, the realization of various needs, all led to the closer association of mankind. But today, society is top-heavy with the overgrowth of supposed human needs. Occidental civilization of the 20th century groans wearily under the tremendous overload of luxury and the inordinate multiplication of human desires and longings. Modern society is enduring the strain of one of its most dangerous phases of far-flung interassociation and highly complicated interdependence.
Okay, so let's get ourselves moving along the line that they're wanting to take us along here. It should be obvious that, like I pointed out as we started out this paper, over and over again, you're seeing them referring indirectly to the developmental epics. Right, the nutrition epic, followed by the security age, that whole bit of how it starts out. History is but the record of man's age-long food struggle. Okay, so just because the nutrition epic is the first one, and there's many subsequent developmental epics, that doesn't mean that one disappears once you go to the security age. It's the inescapable drone tone because it's the foundational element of the whole thing. So just reminding you of that's the first developmental epic, the nutrition epic, followed by the security age, and followed by getting into the material comfort era, where things just push more and more and more to excess, the goodness of the material comfort era initially. All good things taken to extreme become bad, right? Eventually those things get pushed too far, way too far, but that's the whole point of the material comfort era, is to finally get these stark contrasts laid out so that there can be a recognition relative to that differential, and that differential powers you forward to the next developmental epoch, the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Okay. I see. So that's, you know, in many ways, the paragraph is just reminding you of that basic mechanics of development. Now think also, though, about primitive man. You know, why did they italicize? Primitive man only thought when he was hungry. Okay, I mean, there's the initial chuckle of it all, but you know, but think about what. I mean, what do they mean in contrast? Most of the time, mankind is just feeling. Okay, not thinking. You know what I'm about to say, or you should. Ah, why this is so relevant, why they've italicized it. Right? We're way down the road from primitive man, you know, stages, right? But we're getting into this mode where more and more everyone is just feeling their way through life. No one's thinking, right? And it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? So the more that it all is his feelings, of course, God is going to begin to evaporate from the stage. Right? Think about in the primitive man, okay, you've got this one thing that gets him to think instead of just feel his way through his day, and that's food hunger. Okay? And so that thinking is going to be a foundation for his concept of God, his concept of his relationship to God, that time when he actually thinks and hence moves a little Godward. Oh, sacrifice of food to God. See? Now, how did that food get tied to God? Because he's thinking about food. So there's some God there. When it's just feeling, there's just you. There's no God. Right? You're spiritual, but not religious. Right? And that whole bit of, you know, besides, you know, things like food sacrifices, you know, the whole bit of self-denial, self-discipline, fasting. Right? These ways where food is so intimately associated with your concept of God and your relationship to God. And that's why. Because it's your thoughts, even if they're primitive, not your feelings, that leads you Godward. So your initial concept of God.
Bread and wine.
Yeah. Right? And then, of course, it goes on to things like, yeah, bread and wine and whatnot. Yeah. We all know how much relationship food plays, you know, in our whole theological, you know, pictures that we've developed. Okay, so that's, you know, that, I mean, it's not just because it's a chuckle line that they italicized it. See, I mean, you know, just ask yourself, well, wait a minute, why did they italicize that? Why did they want me to really focus on that? And again, if you're just reading this book from the beginning, you know, and you see that, you haven't gotten to it's your thoughts, not your feelings that lead you God, right? But, you know, we're not unpacking this like we're reading it for the first time. We're unpacking in the synthetic mode where we're bringing everything in the revelation to bear on every sentence. Because then and only then we're going to get the truth of that sentence. We don't want to analyze these sentences. We want to recognize them in a synthetic context. Okay, so that's the deal with that, bringing that out. Let's see. And then, right, I mean, you know, Occidental civilization of the 20th century groans wearily. Yeah. How about 100 years later, 100 years hence? Right, I mean, this is part of the big emergency. We are so much into, you know, we think everything is a right now. I mean, we have endless, you know, lists now of I absolutely need this and I absolutely need that, all these things that are my rights and, you know, mine. You can see how, you're just dropping back to that beginning stage of one of your first words. And it's powering this orgy of self-gratification.
Yeah. Just to make an example of that, the rights, the endless rights, I heard on the news that there's some people that are in jail that have been arrested, and they're demanding $11 per hour for their time.
Why not? Right?
I mean, want pay. They called it pay.
Right. And you know that it's getting more and more absurd because, people have discovered, well, hey, it doesn't hurt to just ask because at least 50% of the time you get what you ask for, no matter how ridiculous the request is. You know, and someone says, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Yes, you do have a right to that. We've gotten very coddled, and see, these are the excesses of the material comfort era. It's unfortunate, but it's also look at it as a potential. Look at it as a positive potential instead of a negative actual, and you'll see the goodness that's still there. There's still a thread of truth flowing through that. The more absurd it gets, even as dense as most people are now in terms of their reflective thinking, eventually it's going to get so stark that almost anyone will go, wait a minute, this has gotten totally ridiculous. I don't have a right to be offended, and I certainly don't have a right for you to respect my offense. What am I thinking? Right? You know, I bring that one up a lot because that one's just so ridiculous these days, and
thinking in a tongue,
and it's this whole bit about groans wearily. We were groaning wearily for quite a while, and in the 80s it started to pick up, as I say all the time, and it starts to go exponential in the 90s, and now it is just going completely out of control because we're at that potential end point, at least for the leading edge of civilization, of the material comfort era, where you either, in the stark differential, go, wait a minute, we need something besides quantity here. We need quality. Quality of thinking. And not quantity of feeling. And and those who can make that step in the face of that contrast, see, we'll begin to move forward into the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Or everything just collapses, and it goes back to the first two developmental epochs where fear and hunger reset the foolish notions in your head. And you got to redo the nutrition epoch and the security age. Right, and finally claw your way back to the beginning of the material comfort era and go through the whole rigmarole of gluttony and drunkenness and tyranny and greed and whatnot all over again. Right, so that's the, we're quivering on the very brink, right, of either some who have the capacity taking that step forward in the face of the stark contrast or civilization collapsing and there being an interregnum. And obviously the choice is being made by the leading edge, and if the leading edge chooses, unfortunately, well, everyone else is drugged back with them. Right? There's never been more than 1% in any generation, right, have had the capacity to be the leaders and to be, being the spear point we're talking about. The other 99% plus has always been dependent, always will be dependent on that leading edge. And so if that leading edge collapses, then everyone, perforce, goes back with them. So again, that's what this is all about. That's the fundamental truth that's flowing through these civilization papers.
Is that the danger they're talked about in the next sentence?
Yeah. So You know, modern society is enduring the strain of one of its most dangerous phases. That's, you know, a dangerous phase, whenever they use that, it's some transitional stage, right? Where there's great things on the one side of the binary, you know, but very unfortunate things on the other side. You know, and again, the literalness of danger, you know, the potential for domination, right? The word danger literally means dominate, the root word there. You know, there's a potential for domination, to subject yourself in a very unfortunate fashion, to become subservient to that which you shouldn't be subservient to. These baser instincts on steroids. You know, you put them, you know, you amp them up, and they appear to be a superior thing, but it's a false exaltation. You know, it's just a purely an internal, you know, energy that's driving them up into an apparently higher thing, and you appear to be going upward and, you know, in following that path, but you know, actually it's lower, that, you know, you've kind of basically flipped things around inside, and you're actually going to go down when you appear to go up to that glorious, all of my needs being satisfied, you know, everything I ever desired. You know, a society where no one ever, you know, suffers from greed or anything. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah, wouldn't it be great if it was that totalitarian? Right? Right. Just how totalitarian would it have to be for there to never be negative consequences of greed? Right. You can forget about freedom. Okay. So you get it. That's the spirit of what we're doing here. What else do they say here?
Hunger, vanity, and ghost fear were continuous in their social pressure, but sex gratification was transient and spasmodic. The sex urge alone did not impel primitive men and women to assume the heavy burdens of home maintenance. The early home was founded upon the sex restlessness of the male when deprived of frequent gratification, and upon that devoted mother love of the human female, which in measure she shares with the females of all the higher animals. The presence of a helpless baby determined the early differentiation of male and female activities. The woman had to maintain a settled residence where she could cultivate the soil. And from earliest times, where woman was, has always been regarded as the home.
Okay, so you can see before they really speak directly to these additional things of vanity and ghost fear, like they started the paragraph off with, they want to do a little focus on male-female. And so this is their first significant opportunity to be very politically incorrect. So everyone, you know, if you don't remember what's about to come here, you go, get ready to be objective, to challenge that sense that you have a right to be offended. And but before we get directly to that, just notice how they start out. You know, they aren't saying sex love. See, to start out, they're saying sex gratification. They're saying sex urge. Right, they're using that energy word, urge. You know, so they're reminding you, yeah, we're just the basic energetics that you have with the first adjutant. Okay, not technically love. But you can see that they are getting into this issue of, you know, yet another reason why we need to talk about more than just what brings us together, but what keeps us together. And even though the sex hunger thing is powerful enough that you'll actually use the word love related to it, and have that seem appropriate, You know, it's transient and spasmodic. I mean, this is not going to hold things together. This is very fleeting phenomenon with, you know, that level of energy. Okay, so they're just stressing that that's, you know, yet another reason why something is more, something else has got to hold things together long term. Now, right there in the middle of the paragraph, right, is where you see very directly them trying to get us to recognize a basic difference between men and women in this foundational energy level. Females have maternal instinct. Yes, you know, as they say there. And you notice they use the word love there again, right? Okay, it's not technically love, right? It's the maternal instinct. That devoted mother love of the human female, which in measure she shares with the females of all the higher animals. All right, so there's maternal instinct. But you notice there isn't a parallel paternal instinct. There is no paternal instinct, right? The complementary urge is what? Sex restlessness, right? Sex hunger. I mean, the parallel, males have, you know, have the really definitive sex hunger, and females have the maternal instinct. Right? And if your first thought is, well, wait a minute, I'm offended by that as a male, that you're saying I don't have paternal instinct. Okay, well, you need to recognize that, but there's something higher, less foundational, that both men and women have. They have parental instinct, right? There is a higher instinct that both men and women have in a more equal way, more parallel way. Parental instinct, yes. But paternal, just like maternal, no. No. And the degree to which you assume, like the degree to which a woman assumes that a man has an instinct just like she does, that's just as binding to the child as she feels bound to the child, is the degree to which that woman might, you know, have unfortunate experiences in her life. I mean, that's a very poor assumption for a woman to make, that the guy has the same basic urges that she does. No.
It's more volitional.
Right, I mean, a man, yeah, has to very much, you know, take something that is transient and spasmodic and do something that isn't so in the moment. He has to bring in something higher, you know, something on the second level of meaning, something where you have the long-term adjutants and not the in-the-moment adjutants. It's something that, you know, will span, you know, at least a few moments of time, right? So that there could be something enduring. The feelings of, you know, of parental instincts, you know, are longer term. You think in longer term senses about a child. You know the child starts out as this very helpless babe, and there's this whole, there's this whole long process for that child to be able to stand on its own two feet even, right? Literally, let alone figuratively stand on their own two feet. So it just automatically puts you into a longer term mode with the adjutants, with your mind.
That would create, to be taught that it inundated, really, the society with this idea that's false about men having a paternal urge and then not having it. It might help explain for them, for men, and for women too, you know, some difficulties, and if it was cleared up, it could...
Don't expect me to have something that I don't have, but challenge me to have something that I can choose to take a hold of and hold on to.
Yeah.
All right, challenge me, but don't impose false expectations on me. I mean, it's just chemistry. I mean, I have no control over most of that stuff. It's just the way I am. I mean, you have to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Both men and women, you know, there's these big differences. Men can't expect the things of a woman that can't be expected of a woman. They just aren't what a woman is. Right? Even any more than a man can expect, you know, or a woman can expect something of a man the other way. Right? I mean, it's very important to face facts about the fundamental difference. See, and here's, you notice it's, I mean, it's why they tell you it's, I mean, you're almost like you're different species, right? Because even at the foundational level, there isn't a commonality. I mean, you are differentiated right at the very foundation. So everything is predicated on that differential. Everything is a challenge, you know, right from the get-go to go up to a level where you can find something in common. And fundamentally, of course, if you're going to bridge all the difference, you have to go up to the common fact, the cosmos. Right? You need to turn everything around. Both man and woman need to plant their feet on the cosmos, where there isn't, you know, there aren't male and female personalities. Right? There's only one flavor of personality. It has nothing to do with male and female. Right? And you need to get up there where there is no differential. Right? There's male and female selves and their temperaments.
That's not maybe why they say when the thought adjuster picks the patient.
Right, it has nothing to do with male female because that is just personality, right? Yeah, that's exactly why. Yes, right. It's that the cosmos, you know, there isn't a male cosmos and a female cosmos, and males plant their feet on the male cosmos. You know, that isn't the way it is. There's just one cosmos. It's one universal harmony, something that's transcendent of male and female, and you're trying to challenge yourself to go up to that. Transcend these differences. You want to have a lasting relationship across such a great divide, you perforce must go up. And it's not something you have to build. It's already there. The harmony between men and women already exists. It is the cosmos. You just have to go up and take a hold of it. The answer to the how to bridge the divide is already there, waiting for you to identify with it. Okay, so, all right, there's, you know, that, you have sex hunger on the one side, maternal instinct on the other side, and then,
So before you go on,
yeah.
You know, they do mention that when you think of God the Father and the Son is more like God the Mother, and they mention that, you know, in the paper, one of the first five papers, I forget. So, but the Mother is not necessarily... Well, you know, here the mother is the female, and you know, the father is the male. And so there is they talk about recognizing, you know, I guess it has to do with the love of the two, something like that. If you remember what I'm talking
about. Right, God the Father is not a male, no, God the Mother, and God the Mother is not a female.
Right. some sort of...
So why do they use that? I mean, why do they call the type of deity... that they call the Father. Why do they call that facet of deity the Father? You know, deity functions. So Father deity, what's the basic functioning that is?
Initiator.
Initiator is one of the key things, yes. And the other is direction. Right? You know, like think about when we use Father as a verb, you know, that you're fathering something. See, you're helping to give it direction. Right, so initiator, right, and directionizer, and that direction element actually feeds right into the rest of this paragraph. The contrast that that gets downstepped in men and women. Men are direction and females are place as a foundational differential. Obviously, they can function at higher levels, and there can be overlap, and right. But just the foundational difference of, you know, why there's something called male and why there's something called female, and you know, what is it you see very definitively expressed in differential in material sons and daughters? That contrast, right there, where there's no sort of blurring of the line, a material son is very direction, and a material daughter is very place. And they're very dependent upon each other for, you know, what they aren't. I can be a little bit of place and a little bit of direction because I'm not so precisely expressed like a material son and daughter is. You know, so what they're getting at there at the end is the contrast to that direction, is the place, right? You know, that the woman had to maintain a settled residence where she could cultivate the soil. And you're going, oh, well, she's just, it's just being forced upon her because she's the one, like they said before, that has the helpless baby and she needs to feed it. No, 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 no. No, I mean, it's innate. See, because what does it say next? And from the earliest times, where woman was has always been regarded as the home, because that's what she innately is. Her design is foundationally place. So of course, see, it can't be anything else. Humans picked up on that very early on. It's like, wow, it's just like, this is like just natural that she establishes a place, you know. And it's not just because the baby is. Needs to be fed. It's not something just mechanical and simple like that. People recognized that it was more fundamental than that. That there was this philosophic contrast, philosophical. Maybe I should say in this sense, contrast between men and women. Men are direction and women are place. And so, you know, when men and women work together in a society. You know, in a business context or just in society in general, whatever it is, you know, if we think of them as equal, this is not going to work. They're not equal, mindily or materially, yes, spiritually, but, you know, most businesses are not using spirit substance in their economy. It just is not relevant.
Well, tell me what it is.
I think I was using understatement there. Right, you're looking for an equity, right? You're looking for that harmony. That, you know, if you've tuned into that harmony that is the cosmos, right? The answer is already there in the cosmos of how a business needs to be organized so that men and women work together in cosmic fashion in a harmonious system of equity, right? Predicated on a spiritual equality, right? But there's a mindal and hence material equity system that is that embodies the harmony that is the cosmos. And that's what you're looking for, you know. And it's predicated on this recognition of what's the difference. You can't figure out how you should use a hammer different than a wrench if you haven't figured out exactly what a hammer is about and what a wrench is about, right? And how they work together in some sort of system.
So, when we're thinking about, you know, men and women at work, and like you said earlier, that because you're not a son,
not material son and material daughters, right?
You're not the material son.
There's some blur.
Daughter, there's a lot of blur.
There's some female forms that are more direction-like, you know. There's some male forms that are more place-like, and you got to take that into account. And
when women get a little bit older, there's less of.
They can get more directional. Definitely, and so you have to take that evolution, you know, into account.
So let's just recognize the trends, but treat each individual person individually.
Yeah. Notice how dynamic this has to be. I mean, this can't be something you just figure out and set in stone. I mean, this is a very dynamic thing, because the development of individuals parallels the evolution of the universe. And so in the same way that the life carriers can't just figure out where the Supreme is one time and then they know it for all subsequent times, every 10 worlds, basically, they've got to do a test again. It's like, okay, now where is the Supreme now? Right? Same way with that business. It's like, okay, well, where are my male employees now? Where are my female employees now? Men go through a lot of changes as they age too, just like women do.
Where am I LBGT?
Yeah. Not to mention all, like, it's complicated enough just if we are all material sons and daughters, right? But the fact that there's, you know, we're two bell curves, you know, rather than these two really, you know, very narrow distributions, where these two very broad distributions are all these different, you know, it's a very complicated thing, even more so in an experimental world like ours, where the diversity is even greater. It's going to be very complicated to find a working lasting systemic arrangement of us in our institutions. And you know, we're not going towards that like we were, say, you know, 100 or so years ago. We're going away from that because more and more we're saying, no, we're all born equal. There's no difference between men and women. I mean, all these foolish things that we're imposing upon ourselves, that it's just making it worse. It's hard enough for men and women to get along. It's just going to, all the progress we've made over all these millennia to not just be constantly at each other's throats is all going to fall apart, you know, if we start having these delusional beliefs that there's no difference that we have to take into account, you know?
There are some places that are recognizing that people are very diverse, and they're recognizing that if you put more diverse groups together, that you have way more potential than if you have a lot of people that have the same kind of outlook. And there's a lot of, I know that there are some businesses that are really leveraging groups like that now, and valuing that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, and again, part of it is just because we, you know, if we take things to some extreme delusional state and things just cataclysmically fail because of it, you know, because we're trying to live a falsehood and it just all blows up in our face, you know, people go, oh, wait a minute, there must be something fundamentally wrong with our initial assumptions here. We have a severe reductio ad absurdum here. But, you know, the whole question is whether or not we go into an interregnum or not, is if there's enough people left that can go, you know, there must be a problem with an initial assumption here. That's why things are getting so prickly. Maybe we just need to stop and go way back to the beginning. Let's start with a different initial assumption rather than let's just get a bigger hammer. Let's be more zealous. Let's just try to believe the falsehood, you know, more blindly, whatever.
I know that square peg's going to go.
Right? Everyone knows a big enough hammer and the square peg goes into the round hole. Yeah. So it appears. That's how they're teeing this up. Now they get even a little bit more challenging.
Question on the webinar. About totalitarianism.
Yep.
So William Otto is asking, are the Manchin worlds benevolent totalitarian?
No, they're domains of filled with the potential of liberty, but. Remember how we talk about this some, that from an immature standpoint, the absolute law of the Isle of Paradise would appear to be an absolute bondage, an absolute totalitarian oppression. Even the economy of Havona, even the laws of the House of Havona. Right? I mean, in our immature, especially our Caligastia confused state like we're in, what do you mean? I have to do it exactly like this, and no one is allowed to do it any other way. A certain thing is done in only one way in Havona, and there's no allowance for it to be done any other way. That's horrible. Such oppression. It's like, there is a best way to do something. And there isn't anyone that's ignorant enough that gets into Havona who, would think of doing it any way except the best way. Right? We're still in the mode where we're looking for a better way, but eventually you do get to the best way, and then that's it. It's only done that way because there is no better way to do it. Why would you want to do something in a lesser way? How foolish.
If there is a better way, I will do it in a better way.
All right, but you have perfection of purpose when you get, that's the, how you get into Havona, right? You know the best way to purpose something. So anyway, not to belabor that anymore, but
that's a ways away. But
definitely, as we mature, we're moving into a domain of true liberty, not false liberty. So that's, you know, as you move from here up through the mansion worlds, you are discovering greater personal liberty, but there's ever greater structure that you find that in. Liberty in law. Okay.
Woman thus early became indispensable to the evolving social scheme, not so much because of the fleeting sex passion as in consequence of food requirement. She was an essential partner in self-maintenance. She was a food provider, a beast of burden, a companion who would stand great abuse without violent resentment. And in addition to all of these desirable traits, she was an ever-present means of sex gratification.
Well, okay, so for the women in the room... Do you feel objectified? Okay, you know, obviously that's the paragraph where it gets rugged. Think about this in a primitive developmental context. If you're honest with yourself, you know how this works. Why it works this way. You know, when they say these desirable traits, how horrible. Saying that males' abuse of females is a desirable state like that? No. What's the thread of truth that's flowing through that? There's another instinct that a woman has that is very desirable and doesn't take any sort of horrid expressions if the male is a human instead of an animal. A woman has a bonding instinct. Besides having a maternal instinct, a woman has a bonding instinct, and that can be one of the most cherished things that a man can experience, right? But obviously it's an Achilles heel too, that many men recognize and greatly abuse. We all know that's how women get abused, by men taking advantage, you know, more so than their maternal, taking advantage of maternal instinct, taking advantage of that bonding instinct. Women have to, young girls need to be taught by women about this and to not cast their pearls before swine. Because that is a great pearl, a pearl of great price that she possesses, that she can give to a man. But it needs to be a man, not an animal, not a swine. So, that aside, about the truth there and the majesty that's there, things start out pretty crude. And, there's a lot of antagonisms, guys are very bellicose, in general by nature. And they're just pointing out, it's actually a great relief. It might seem like an oppression of women, but it's actually this, the woman is giving the man this refuge from, he has a tendency to be gruff. And when he's a gruff with a male, the other male picks up a battle axe and wants to fight to the death. That can get a little old. So, see, the man is looking for a contrast to that, where everything that comes out of his ignorant mouth isn't met with, someone throwing down the gauntlet, and this has got to be a duel to the death now. But it's, remember that a lot of what you're talking about when you're talking about primitive men and women, it is a lot of kind of an animal phenomenon. And so don't judge it in human terms. It just is the way it is. There's a reason why immediately in a normal world you have a prince and his staff come to try to supply a positive influence so that these animal things, these urges that bring you together, there's an influence so that they don't get, taken to very unfortunate extremes where women get too abused, or whatnot. We have a rebellion and then we even lost our Adam and Eve example of such things. And so, there's been a lot of this, and it's only in recent times that we're trying to come out of this. Yeah, we'll get into all these details about men and women much more so when we get to the marriage and family papers, down the road a ways, after Adam and Eve. But they're giving you this little vignette on it here. But again, think about the place, they already mentioned the whole food provider thing. But even the beast of burden, the tendency in, primitive societies where the woman is always the beast of burden. You see these women in Africa or something, with huge piles of stuff, they're on their backs or heads or whatnot that they're carrying along. I mean, again, it's just kind of a natural thing because of that place. Like, you're willing to kind of be with a bunch of stuff in a place, whereas a guy is just this direction running away from all these other objects. He puts something on his head and then runs out from underneath it because he's so direction-like and doesn't want to be placed like with that object and stay with it. So the natural tendencies just kind of lead to this, besides any sort of male oppression of females, that might feed into that as well. So just note that. That's what they're hoping that, that people appreciate here. So besides the self-perpetuation and the self-maintenance issues here between men and women, right? And she wasn't ever-present means of sex gratification, right? There's also that, remember in the third paragraph there, we had the self-perpetuation, self-maintenance, self-gratification. That triplet that we're going to touch upon a lot here. The universe gives us that as a gift, the potential for pleasure. Remember, it's been a long time now, but you can go back to the end of paper 34 and remind yourself, like I so often do, because it's one of the most potent statements in the entire book. Go back to the end of paper 34, next to the last paragraph. What does it say? The normal urges, right, the normal urges of animal beings and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons. We impose, St. Augustine notions of sex upon ourselves and stuff, get all wrapped around the axle about it, as if it's in some conflict with spirit and God and stuff. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's where that comes from. That's what that italicized sentence, that whole bit about how these foundational things were immediately getting tied to God, like hunger, like food hunger. See, we're still in that mode where the fanciest things we can think of, we use words like God and spirit. We say that, intense sexual engagement was a spiritual experience. We'll say things like this, and you have religious doctrines that aggrandize sexual things and whatnot. See, again, those feelings with sex. Feelings is not spirit. It's your thoughts, not your feelings that lead you Godward. It's your thoughts that lead you to spirit, and God is spirit, not feelings. Feelings have nothing to do with spirit. A simple thing, where do you find the adjuster and where do you find that connection to God in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind? And at that upper domain, that when the revelators use the word heart, that's what they're referring to, that upper domain. Where are feelings? Down in the lower domain. So put the two together. Are there any feelings in the upper domain? Are there any feelings in the heart? No. Not as the revelators use the word heart. Humans use the word heart as a synonym for feelings. Right? The actual inner sanctum, right, that domain is transcendent of feelings. It's above. Right? It begins one level plus above the level of the feelings. Now, no, don't forget that even though in and of itself the heart, there are no feelings in the heart, that domain is above the level of feelings. It's dominant over the level of feelings. Anything that happens on the third through the sixth levels of meaning will energize the second level of meaning, the feelings below. Any activity in the heart will produce a feeling below because that upper domain is dominant over the lower domain. Right? But don't think that the feelings are the heart. Right? You know, it's like saying God is love, but love is not God. Right? Don't put an equal sign there. Right? So activity in the heart will produce feelings, but feelings don't imply that you're in the heart. So these issues with pleasure, including sex gratification. I mean, there's nothing evil there. Evil's a spirit word. Doesn't have anything to do with spirit. And it's high time that mankind differentiated these things.
There's
all these issues of monogamy, even true monogamy, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, all those issues are there and stuff. But you have to, if you're going to understand what true monogamy is, you have to first, like we're pointing out, we have to have a better definition for the word love, and we have to differentiate matter from spirit, and all. Improved. Concepts of monogamy are predicated on an improved understanding of these foundational issues of what's spirit and what isn't. And, when people say soulful, when people say spiritual, recognize. You should be recognizing now. Step back and think about what they're actually talking about. Oh, what they actually mean is feelingful there, don't they? And, it is. I mean, soulful music isn't literally soulful music. It's feelingful music. Again, it's not a dichotomy. Just because the heart doesn't have feelings in it doesn't mean heart is good and feelings are bad. Again, it has not, no. Feelings are feelings. It's like you just, they're different, and separate them. Yeah. If you think that your entire genuine conscious self is your feelingful self, right, how are you ever going to find the heart? If you're certain that you'd never want to journey out of the domain of feelings in your mind because you'd be journeying out of the heart, you'll never actually get to the heart. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. So you'll never actually get Godward if you stay in that space in your mind of feelings. Right? You'll be left with just the feeling of reverence, the reverence of unity. You'll never actually get to the worship of God. Now, the worship of God, the genuine worship of God, will have consequent feelings associated with it. Right? But the worship of God itself is not the feeling of reverence. right, what else do they say here?
Almost everything of lasting value in civilization has its roots in the family. The family was the first successful peace group, the man and woman learning how to adjust their antagonisms while at the same time teaching the pursuits of peace to their children.
Okay, so two big things there. You notice just that one little paragraph, and then they want you to pause and reflect. Okay, first of all, let's start with the main antagonist, to adjust their antagonisms. Right? Men and women are naturally antagonistic. So you don't want to start with the belief, oh, well, naturally, we get along perfectly. So let's make that our initial assumption. You know, and then if we don't, oh, well, this must not be the right match for me. It's like, no, you're confused. All right? The whole point is you couldn't be more different. Sex hunger and maternal instinct, you know, are at loggerheads right from the get-go. And it just builds up, you know, from there. You have to challenge yourself to go up to transcend the differentials, the conflicts, the antagonisms. That's where the true relationship lies. So how does that, you know, that effort in the microcosm like that, how does that impact civilization? Well, that's where the peace comes in. And so, you know, just think about how absurd, how many absurd things are happening on the planet right now, where you have people who give lots of lip service to the word peace, but do they have the foundation of peace? Is there peace in their home? Do they even have a home? Right? So if you don't have the source space for peace in the world, how is there going to be peace in the world? Right? It starts in the home and it redounds to the world. Right? You get so much peace, you know, in that small space that it overflows and begins to spread over the earth. And then eventually there's peace on earth. But every little family has to be a reservoir of overflowing peace. And then and only then will there be peace on earth. Right? But instead believing, well, we're just going to somehow have peace on earth, and then that'll flow back in and fill in my little well of home. No, it doesn't work that way. Okay? Yeah, so just see, they want you to really recognize the physics of this, how this peace thing works.
It's just going to download it, yeah. Like a file.
If you can't get along with someone of the opposite sex, how on earth are you going to get along with someone in a radically different culture? I mean, this is completely delusional. If there can't be peace in the home first, there's never going to be peace between, you know, Eastern civilization and Western civilization or something like that, between Christianity and Islam or whatever. Because you discover, in transcending the difference between male and female, you discover the truth of how to transcend the difference between Christianity and Islam. Because, of course, there is no potential for peace when you stay down in the plane of Christianity and Islam. You got to get above both of those religions to find peace on earth. You got to transcend all of these bottom-up religions that we have. These outer life so-called religions. Genuine religion is an inner life fact, not an outer life fact. It's not a social fact, it's an individual fact. Et cetera. As we always point out, you could go on basically for 2 hours on every paragraph, the consequences of all of what they're bringing out. But big issue. So, you know, they're just giving you those little thoughts. You know, you go, oh, peace. I love the word peace. Here's a paragraph about peace. You know, well, take a hold of it. Learn the physics of peace. If you want to be an advocate for peace, you've got to know the physics of peace. You have to face facts and adjust them to the ideal of peace in order to achieve the wisdom for genuine peace.
That passes all.
Yeah. Right. Obviously, peace on earth, you know, begins with a peace inside you as an individual that passes all understanding. All right, what else do they say here?
The function of marriage and evolution is the insurance of race survival, not merely the realization of personal happiness. Self-maintenance and self-perpetuation are the real objects of the home. Self-gratification is incidental and not essential, except as an incentive ensuring sex association. Nature demands survival, but the arts of civilization continue to increase the pleasures of marriage and the satisfactions of family life.
Okay, so like I said, I mean, all these things are, you know, we treat in great detail in the marriage and family papers, but they're giving you these fundamental little elements that they expand on up there. Here's another fundamental element. There needs to be a precisely differentiated institution in civilization that's not, as they say, not merely about the realization of personal happiness, but is fundamentally, you know, about the self-maintenance and self-perpetuation issues, not the self-gratification. The Revelators use the word marriage for that institution. Right? So not the ever more generalized usage that we have these days. You know, they say, no, you need to recognize there's a precise phenomenon that needs to have a name. You can have other phenomena. Right? It's not that you're not going to have other pairings, other modes of pairing, but you have to recognize there's a certain type of pairing and only a certain type of pairing that procreates. Right? And you could take this to a definitive degree. If a man and, you know, and set aside male-male, female-female pairings, but even a male-female pairing, if the whole point is not procreation, okay, it's technically not a marriage the way the Revelators are using the word marriage. Right? And they're trying to get that word marriage focused on very precisely. Because you have to recognize that there's more to consider than self-gratification. See, and just notice that more and more we're getting fixated on self-gratification. So we're thinking that marriage is just about self-gratification and hence could be generalized. Okay, yeah. Okay, there's a general self-gratification issue. You know, we need to address that. But that's separate from addressing the self, especially the self-perpetuation, right? Let alone the self-maintenance. Right? Marriage, as the Revelators use the term, is an institution of self-perpetuation, most foundationally, you know, even more than self-maintenance. Two males or two females can't procreate, and a lot of males and females aren't interested in procreating in their pairing. That whole issue of civilization needs be ongoing because there's children and grandchildren. I mean, that's a physics of civilization that needs to be precisely addressed, separate from, as they're saying, you know, merely the realization of personal happiness. Okay, now note that they do say happiness and even personal happiness. They're reminding you that that the whole power of a pairing of any flavor is the differential. Is the degree to which it's not automatic and natural, but is but requires a transcendence of that contrast. Okay, and you know, remember that's the whole difference between joy and happiness. And right? If there's just a natural feeling of commonality, you could call that feeling joy. But if you're choosing to respond positively to a negative influence, right, Right. If there, you know, there is that contrast, and so the contrast is a negative influence, it's, you know, even to the point of an antagonism, right? You know, that's what they're getting at, is you're choosing as a person to respond positively, to go up in the face of the contrast down below, you know, going above a natural joy to an unnatural, to an artful, to an artificial happiness. Right? So, you know, notice they use, like I said, they always use these little passing comments as an opportunity to get you to reflect a little bit more. What's it, you know, what's the proper definition of the word happiness? Happiness is a choice. Joy is a spiritual experience, but happiness is a choice. Happiness is unnatural.
Yeah. Of happiness, man knows very little.
Yes. And because it's sad to record that so few persons, I mean, there's so little genuine human personal phenomena, you know, instead of just fancy animal. That's why we know so little of happiness. You know, it's also, I mean, it goes hand in hand. We also know so little of genuine religion, you know, if you come think about the consequences of that statement about happiness. But yeah, that challenge to not use happiness for this, you know, the low things. Just like we're talking about, don't use love for all those lower levels of meaning things. It'll put love all the way up in the sixth level. Happiness is another one. Right? Happiness is discovered on the sixth level of meaning, not some fancy animal thing down there on the level of the feelings. Right? It's a choice where in the face of what would produce a very negative state if you just submitted to it, you know, sorrow, sadness, whatever, you know, you say, no, I'm sovereign, you know, in the upper domain of my mind, and I choose to transcend that natural response. I'm not going to take offense at my spouse, which is natural, because basically everything they think and do is going to strike me as annoying because it's so different, right? And so my animal instinct response, you know, takes offense at that. And you know, and if I have self-respect issues, I kind of, you know, blow on that and amp that up to try to improve my sense of self, you know, at in my case, her expense. Right?
So my son says to me, he says, Dad, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy?
I mean, right. The animal wants to be right. Right? You know, you need to mature beyond that. Because there's delights in sharing the harmony of the cosmos that few people have ever experienced. Much, much more pleasurable than the delights that are so self-contained. Right?
And that rightness versus the happiness, you know, comes from also a thing of really, really trying to understand one another, because you think you can put yourself in that person's shoes and place where, as you really can't, especially on the opposite sex side of things.
Yeah.
You don't have the same.
You don't even. You, on it right. You can't. You can't. I mean, the foundational instincts are don't overlap. They're just disjoint. I mean, totally separate. You can't put yourself, you know, in her moccasins if you're a male, and a female can't put herself in his moccasins. You can't.
In some ways, experiencing joy, you can, to a certain degree, of something that's mutual, you can have certain things. But you're right.
And just recognize the whole point is not to try to somehow put yourself in the other person's moccasins. The whole point is for both of you to go up. You know, the point is not for Christians to actually kind of get the Muslims or Muslims to get the Christians. The point is for both of them to transcend Christianity and Islam to something higher. That's the whole point.
So, when you were talking earlier, you said that love, true, genuine love, on the sixth level, mm-hmm. is beyond unselfish or selfless.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, right. I mean, there requires something external that you're choosing to respond to. I mean, you can't have happiness just in a vacuum. You know, any more than you can have love in a vacuum. I mean, love is a personal realization of divine fellowship. Fellowship, okay? This isn't just you. You know, you can find, if you think love is a feeling, that can be something that is totally bottled up inside of you, self-contained. See, that's not genuine love. Right? The phenomenon, the motion in your mind that is genuine love is this personal response. You know, this using your personality, grip on spirit, and spirit's dominance over mind, to put the mind in an unnatural state, in an unnatural motion that's tied to this linkage to the divine. Right? There's a divine fellowship that, you know, that technically you're just given by grace, but you have to take a hold of that and personally realize it, individuate it within yourself. You know, in that absolutely unique way that your personality does it. See, it can't be given to you. I mean, the Universal Father doesn't have your personality. No one has your personality. No one can give you that personal realization. Only you can pattern it, you know, and realityize it in you. You know, so that's, you know, that whole bit of, you know, just, it's one thing to just let spirit flow through you. It's another thing to actually take a hold of it and individuate it out of the ocean, you know, of spirit, realityize it in you. Love is a, you know, it's a spirit word like that. It's, you know, see, and obviously the same thing with religion, personal spiritual experience. It's not just merely spiritual experience where I can just put myself in some bath where there's this group religious thing, and then see, obviously it's perforce individuated, absolutely individuated, you know, and is only in the upper domain where there's personalized self. It's not an outer life issue. Okay. Let's see. So did we get everything there? The whole bit with we'll get more on the whole bit of the pleasure mania, you know, of the self-gratification on steroids that we're into these days. But you know, how they end there, you know, notice that, you know, you've gone beyond mere society or even mere culture to civilization. You know, so that you have the arts of civilization, when you can take what is fundamentally, like very foundationally, just self-perpetuation, and, you know, and in addition, self-maintenance, when you can artfully bring in self-gratification to that institution as well, round it out, without it being destructive. See, it's going to take art. Like they're saying, see, the arts of civilization continue to increase the pleasures of marriage and the satisfactions of family life. See, and just notice that between the lines there, oh, so naturally, it's probably not just sunshine and lollipops, is it? Right? The satisfactions of family life. Okay, who's going to get up now, you know, and change the diapers at 2 a.m? And right, right, we all know there's a lot of rigors to this stuff. It's not naturally pleasurable. All right.
If vanity be enlarged to cover pride, ambition, and honor, then we may discern not only how these propensities contribute to the formation of human associations, but how they also hold men together. Since such emotions are futile without an audience to parade before. Soon vanity associated with itself other emotions and impulses which required a social arena wherein they might exhibit and gratify themselves. This group of emotions gave origin to the early beginnings of all art, ceremonial, and all forms of sportive games and contests.
Okay, so so kind of using vanity as a generalized word, like they're saying there, to cover pride, ambition, and honor, and just having all those sorts of emotions and appreciating how in a primitive state, it's that stuff that keeps it together. You know, you get together for some transient reason, and then you discover, oh, this is cool. There's, you know, there's fringe benefits to being in close association like this. You know, I can do the whole peacock thing and strut my stuff. I've got an audience. And so, you know, you find delight in that, and so you keep it going. Notice they even throw in pride. The reason that they can throw in pride and not, that not have immediately have pride goeth before a fall, is because in a very primitive state, there's so little genuine spiritual, you know, the danger is pretty limited. But definitely by the time you have Jesus as a spiritual uplifter, right, and you know, he knows that in the wake there's going to be a lot more natural spiritual energy going on, you know, spirit energy influence on our minds, you know, he's very tough on that pride thing. It's like, no, don't even think about it. It's not a small thing anymore. It's a mustard seed. And if you put even a drop of water on it, it's going to explode into a huge problem. You're going to have way more spiritual energy now. But way back then, even, you know, far enough back, and even pride, see, you could go, well, you know, if pride was absolutely destructive, it wouldn't exist, right? That would never occur in humans. See, so you know the fact that it's there, you must be able to find some place in the evolutionary or developmental, you know, sequence where it has some measure of positive, some measure of goodness. It might be quite fleeting and quite limited, you know, in scope where it's proper, but nonetheless, you know, there must be some place, sometime, or it just wouldn't exist at all. If it was absolutely a negative, it wouldn't exist.
So does that mean there's only one absolute negative, which is inequity for the individual? Otherwise, there's no absolute negative.
Yeah, and of course, you know, technically, absolute negative is absolutely nothing. You know, I mean, yeah.
So that's it.
Yeah.
Inequity is good for the universe.
Right, but again, but not in and of itself. It's in contrast. It's the potential to have an unnatural response to that natural stimulus. Right? I mean, like the adjuster in that person that goes to iniquity. Yeah, the adjuster doesn't go down to iniquity with the individual. The adjuster, you know, responds reciprocally, you know, and goes upward. As much as the individual goes down, they go up. And they go all the way down to you know, finite iniquity, you know, the antithesis of supremacy. That means the adjuster goes up to supremacy, and you have a supreme adjuster. Right, so, you know, there's, you know, just the, and that's another thing, too, about pride, ambition, and honor, the fact that there's this audience that you're parading for, right there is that contrast. The audience now has an opportunity to respond positively to your negative stimulus of being very empty and just parading about, you know, all about you. You know, you can go, wow, that's really destructive. I'm not going to be all about me. There's a poster child for how that's not a good option. Right? See, so, all right, so initially just that, you know, the inevitabilities. Remember, you know, you always have the inevitability contrast, you know, in play with that stuff too. So
if pride there's some potential for good, does it have any part that's good in a young child growing up?
Yeah, see, again, I mean, just the fact that it's a spirit word, I mean, at least there's some spirit influence on the mind. We'll work on improving the quality of it later, you know, but there has to be something before it can be better. See, so just the fact that, you know, in and of itself, mind is not prideful. That, you know, the mind has that motion called pride in it because it's responding to a spirit energy stimulus. So, you know, it's very much like I always point out. I mean, initially, your spiritual consciousness is, you know, your immature spiritual consciousness is nothing but an error and evil detector. You know, you use it in negative mode. I mean, that's just how you inescapably start out. And then you have to take a hold of it and turn it around and make it a positive phenomenon. But initially, you know, that spirit influence on the mind, you know, tends to take things negative. I mean, it's gasoline on a fire, you know, initially. Okay.
Vanity contributed mightily to the birth of society, but at the time of these revelations, the devious strivings of a vainglorious generation threatened to swamp and submerge the whole complicated structure of a highly specialized civilization. Pleasure want has long since superseded hunger want. The legitimate social aims of self-maintenance are rapidly translating themselves into base and threatening forms of self-gratification. Self-maintenance builds society. Unbridled self-gratification unfailingly destroys civilization.
Okay, see, so obviously that final paragraph is pushing to why the book is in my lap in the first place. What's the emergency? What's, you know, it's a civilizational emergency, and they're giving you, you know, focusing in on one of the key elements of why there's an emergency. How have we gotten to this point where literally a super universe mobilized to try to help out? It's that bad. I mean, you know, it would be bad enough if the local universe felt it had to mobilize, but the fact that the super universe felt it had to mobilize, that means it's, you know, we're quivering on the very brink of calamity here. You know, of a super universe scale. I mean, that's how far we're potentially going to fall, right? And reciprocal to the grandness of a super universe, right? We're potentially going to have the reciprocal of that in the negative, right? That deep an interregnum, that divorced from the cosmos. You know, it's hugely important to catch yourself getting caught up in the common, so-called, you know, common or conventional wisdom, you know, which is anything but wise. It's completely ignorant and self-destructive. This whole pleasure mania.
Chris?
Yeah.
I think the downside of the technology and digital world has made this happen on steroids.
Yeah, I mean,
pleasure mania.
Yeah, right. There's just so many ways to just descend into that blob of protoplasm that does nothing but feel and demands stimuli that produce positive feelings.
Yeah,
and nothing else.
It's a huge problem.
Right.
What are we supposed to do?
Right? I mean, and again, remember, none of us are supposed to do anything, initially at least, in the outer life.
I just want to go home and
step one,
in my bedroom.
It all begins with you. Seek first the kingdom of heaven. Right? Don't seek first a way to improve the external world. Seek first a way to actually go above feelings inside with reflective thinking that leads you Godward. Nucleate yourself. Find your personal self. Find your potential for self-mastery, you know, and then be determined to supply those favorable conditions to be grown into self-mastery. Loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient.
Right? As it crumbles around us, like, rapidly.
That movie Bruce Almighty, where it says, be the miracle, so to speak.
I mean, it's just, what the world needs is the exercise of our sovereign potential. And our sovereignty potential is not in the external world, right? It's only in the upper domain. It's not even in the lower domain, right? It's only in the upper domain.
And it doesn't mean you sit there in your room and don't talk to them.
I mean, you won't. Yes, exactly. You won't be able to sit in your room. I mean, if you genuinely do get emotion going in the upper domain, remember, it's dominant over the lower domain, which is dominant over the external world. I mean, it automatically flows down and out. It can't do anything else, right? It's just the physics of it, right? The degree to which you have to try to somehow force something out, see, is the degree to which you're delusional, right? You haven't actually gotten up, right? The fruits of the Spirit are automatic. They don't have to be somehow made to happen. They're automatic. Now, the fact that the fruits of the Spirit aren't manifesting is because there is no genuine spirit inside of all these fancy animals. It's sad to record that so few persons, right? Right? It's like, no, I'm very spiritual. No, you're feelingful. The fruits of feelingfulness are not automatic. And the only time that the fruits of feelingfulness manifest is if you amp them up enough that the feeling becomes an emotion, right? It has you have a physiological response.
Forcing anything out that immediately made me think of self-assertion. Yeah. But anytime you're trying to force something, it is trying to, you know, fit that circle in a square.
Yeah, the square peg in a round hole. Yes, it is. Yes.
And it's just like maybe that will help with more patience and humble. Yeah. And
yeah, you don't have to worry about being a positive influence. If you genuinely find some personal nature, you will be a blessing to the world. You can't be anything else. Right? It's automatic. You will, at least help those immediately around you, if not to a greater degree.
You start to notice it coming out.
Just
day in and day out.
That's what Jesus meant by. That's what Jesus meant by seek first the kingdom of heaven, right? You will always go down a false path in responding to that if you haven't separated matter or spirit from matter yet. See.
That's what I'm supposed to do.
You got it. Right? I mean, as long as the word spirit. It's just a word that applies to fancy matter or feelings about fancy matter, right? You will always have a false kingdom of heaven, yeah, that you're seeking first. Using that test, if I have to consciously assert myself for there to be so-called fruits of the Spirit manifesting from me, see, those aren't genuinely fruits of the Spirit. And the genuine fruits of the Spirit come out automatically. Can't do anything else.
Those are the nuts of the Spirit.
All right, I think we have time. We can probably get in here in this section 3. What else do we have here?
Number 3, socializing influence of ghost fear. Primitive desires produced the original society. The ghost fear held it together and imparted an extra human aspect to its existence. Common fear was physiological in origin. Fear of physical pain, unsatisfied hunger, or some earthly calamity. But ghost fear was a new and sublime sort of terror.
Okay. Now, we want to appreciate, besides kind of the almost comical sort of historical picture here, the essence of what's there at the end. But ghost fear was a new and sublime sort of terror. Remember how this works. In the lower domain, in the hourglass analogy of your mind or self, as they just said there, common fear was physiological in origin. The foundation, the zeroth level of meaning, is the level of fear. And the whole lower domain is predicated on that foundation. Can't be anything else. It all sits on that foundation. So that's just automatic. That fundamentally, as you go up in the lower domain, just the lower domain unto itself, yeah. So forget about the neck and the possibility of influence coming down from above into the lower domain, but just what bubbles up, what wells up from the foundation, there really can't be anything except that foundational raw animal origin fear and then just ever more sublime exaltations of it. Right? And so as you go up from the zeroth level of meaning with just that basic physiological fear, you have anguish and dread on the first level of meaning. And those are just amped up fear. And then if you take it up to the second level of meaning, where now you bring in those long-term adjectives. So there's, you kind of spread it out of an intense moment. You have the two flavors of exalted fear there. You have awe on the individuality side and reverence on the unity side. Right? So remember, I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, when you say like dread, it's like, you know, you immediately think fear. But even when you go all the way up to the most sublime reverence, right, that's just still fear. Like I try to point that out, the word revere, right, the root word is fear. It's re-fear. Right? It's fear again. Right? It's this fear made very sublime, see, in unity, like you spread it out so it doesn't have that intense in the individuality thing, right? But it has this power to it. But, you know, you've diffused it out with that unity. That's what that's all reverence, just in and of itself, bottom up.
So
that's
respect fear then also?
No, I mean that's going above, yeah. But just down in the lower domain, you know, the word itself, reverence, is reminding you that it's all predicated on that foundation of fear, and so, you know, that whole fear of the Lord element. See, this is a beginning. You start with just, you know, physiological fear, you know, and your God is some very material notion. But it slowly gets up until that fear of the Lord is reverence. Okay. But, you know, it's still, in just that bottom-up mode is quite limited. You're needing revelation. You're needing something to lead you up. But that's what they're, you know, what they're getting at here, between the lines. Is that, you know, even if you have this very primitive, you know, from our perspective in many ways, silly notions about a spirit world, you know, quote unquote, ghosts and, you know, whatnot, whatever you call that spirit world, whatever words you use, spirit, ghost, or what have you, you know, it's a notion of something less material. You know, remember, before you can get to spiritual, you have to at least have not matter. You know, it starts out, you know, you have matter, and then you have some notion of not matter, and it's, you know, and eventually, if you keep following that, you'll actually get to genuine spirit substance. But so it's a beginning by having this, you know, especially with the ghost. You know, the ghost thing is, you know, is you've got this being that used to be corporeal, you know, it isn't just, you know, some spirit being that never was corporeal before, you know. So the word ghost, you know, has that linkage. So you're kind of transcending the material a little bit to something that's more ethereal, you know. And remember, the initial notion is, you know, it's that least tangible thing that you've noticed, breath, right? And so, you know, these ghosts are breath beings, you know, basically. And yeah,
who do you call?
Okay. Okay. But anyway, the really key word there is sublime. See, it seems just funny, the new and sublime sort of terror, but see, there's a thread of truth there in that, how sublime reverence is relative to just raw animal, you know, fear, you know, like of an earthly calamity, like they're saying, or something. Yeah. Fear of a hurricane, or fear of the glaciers back, you know, and the glaciers, you know, in the primitive man or whatever.
Well, so ghost fear, in a way, then, is even recognizing something beyond just the material.
Yeah.
So it's the beginning of something else.
And maybe just one other little thing to note, you know, remember how, you know, when the revelators are bringing in genuine spirit influence, they use the word danger. Okay? See, there's a truth there about this new and sublime sort of terror. You know, it's like, oh, it's spirit. There's nothing to worry about. It's all going to be sunshine and lollipops. It's like, no, that's your ignorance. If you actually knew the potentials of spirit influence on you, you'd be afraid. You know, it's the Luke Skywalker thing, right? And Yoda, I'm not afraid. You will be. Right? I mean, you know, initially you have to have that. You got to sober. You know, I mean, spirit isn't just actually dangerous, it's really dangerous. Right? You can destroy your soul with spirit substance. You can't destroy your soul with a hydrogen bomb or anything like that, or some literal sort of steel. But you can destroy your soul with spirit substance. So, you know, initially that should sober you. You know, there's that. You know, but immediately take a hold of it, and not let it be literally fear, but let it be focus, controlled fear. Right? Use it at focus. Focus on it. I need to get serious about spirit. I can't just be skipping around, you know, thinking there's nothing, no real harm can befall me with spirit. No, real harm can befall you with spirit substance. You need to know what you're doing, or don't be doing anything at all.
Focus is what the mother gives.
Yeah. I mean, that self-mastery of focusing in, you know, conquered fear and using the focusing aspect of fear. Okay, keep on.
Probably the greatest single factor in the evolution of human society was the ghost dream. Although most dreams greatly perturb the primitive mind, the ghost dream actually terrorized early men, driving these superstitious dreamers into each other's arms in willing and earnest association for mutual protection against the vague and unseen imaginary dangers of the spirit world. The ghost dream was one of the earliest appearing differences between the animal and human types of mind. Animals do not visualize survival after death.
So in order to have that, you have to have personality, so there can be a concept of the future. You know, just in general, you know, let alone something specific like survival after death. I mean, predicated on a notion of the future. You can't just be existing in the moment like an animal. Right, so you have to have the great, you know, the imaginative abilities, and you have to have the you know, that rudimentary personal consciousness that we're given by grace that puts the word future in the dictionary. And just, you know, again, like I said, remember about the contrast between, you know, eventually you had ghosts contrasted to spirit beings. You know, this ghost dream, you know, you have this, your greatest material enemy, and you've been, you know, struggling with, you know, with them all your life, you know, and finally you beat them and kill this enemy. And then what happens?
You dream about it.
Then you dream about him, and he's still alive, and it's still coming at you, right? So, right. See, that's what they're getting at there. It holds people together because you. It's like, well, we got to dream up some whole rigmarole to somehow combat this, you know. And one person can't do it. You know, it's so great. You know, it's beyond the woo-woo of one person. It's going to take the whole village, you know, to do some fancy dance or something to try to somehow stop this. Yeah, and that's what they're getting at. All right, keep going.
Except for this ghost factor, all society was founded on fundamental needs and basic biologic urges, but ghost fear introduced a new factor in civilization, a fear which reaches out and away from the elemental needs of the individual, and which rises far above even the struggles to maintain the group. The dread of the departed spirits of the dead brought to light a new and amazing form of fear, an appalling and powerful terror, which contributed to whipping the loose social orders of early ages into the more thoroughly disciplined and better controlled primitive groups of ancient times. This senseless superstition, some of which still persists, prepared the minds of men through superstitious fear of the unreal and the supernatural for the later discovery of the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. The baseless fears of evolution are designed to be supplanted by the awe for deity inspired by revelation. The early cult of ghost fear became a powerful social bond, and ever since that far distant day, mankind has been striving more or less for the attainment of spirituality.
See, that last little bit I was speaking to before, you know, you don't start literally going right from matter to spirit, but you begin this journey towards spirit, you know, and it's ever more transcendent degrees of not matter. You know, yet even not more not matter and more not matter until finally you can actually get to spirit. Notice how they were indicating that there early on. See, it's a fear which reaches out and away, see, from the elemental needs of the individual. It's just starting to bias you away from all about matter. So it's positive, even though there's all these goofy superstitions and notions that tie to it, but it has that positive truth to it, that it's moving away from matter to some degree, to an eventual discovery of spirit. And, of course, reminding us that some of which still persists, right? Right, that's the big challenge, is there anything going on in religion besides, you know, primitive superstitions? Now, notice one of the ways that so-called religions have gotten away from just lots of dogmas and rituals about primitive superstitions is they've ceased to have any relationship to spirit at all and have just become social groups. Okay, that's an unfortunate solution to the problem. Nonetheless, yeah, you had something, Gene?
Well, I was thinking, these things are, while they're primitive, they're evolving.
Yep.
So they're good and positive.
Right.
But if we've reached a point where we're not evolving, but materialism is taking possession of our minds,
mm-hmm.
and we're moving away from spirit and back towards a material understanding of everything.
Yep.
Rather than being progressing and uplifting, these things can become the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And to lend to our destruction.
Yeah, disintegration at least, you know, unraveling, you know, I mean, retrograde, yeah. It's just like I was saying a while back, if you get it in your head that less thinking, more feeling is progress. No, that's 180 degrees, right?
You haven't got it in your head.
remember how this works. If you have this whole feelingful, feelingism, you know, basically that's your worldview, you know, yeah, that's fundamentally in the lower domain, but you have a notion, you have a cultural belief, getting to that in the next section, but a cultural belief, a more, that you really have effectively put in the upper domain and it rules the lower domain. So you put that, you sort of absolutize the idea that, or the notion that more feeling, less thinking is progress, is progressive, you know, is a positive thing. That becomes your inner more, you enslave the upper domain to that belief, and then that upper domain rules the lower domain. Everything in the lower domain is predicated on that belief then. Right? Your conscience reminds you, you know, when you start giving thinking too much credence and not being totally biased towards feeling. See, that becomes your conscience, you know, that voice from above, that voice of the more system coming down. So, you know, it's how we, you know, these things become conventionalized and then very difficult to break out of, because you've sort of, you know, you've existentialized these falsehoods in your mind. You know, you've given them that existential grip of your personality in the upper domain. You know, you've lifted something from the lower into the upper. Instead of having what's in the upper coming down from the cosmos, you've burped something up from below, right, and existentialized it up there. You know, and that becomes your cosmos. That becomes your norm, your reference. The one fun little thing in there, sort of most foundationally, the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom, you know, that is from Proverbs. I mean, it extends to other places, but, you know, thinking of that as a line from Proverbs there. Think about what I was just saying about, you know, the fear foundation and the upwelling in the lower domain. So the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. So you go all the way up to that refined fear of reverence on the second level of meaning with the sixth adjutant. Okay, what if you went up? Right, the seventh adjutant on the third level of meaning, the beginning of wisdom, right? It's not wisdom, but it's the spirit of wisdom. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's not, you know, a personal living philosophy, but it is a philosophic impulse. See? You can literally see the truth of that line from Proverbs in the hourglass analogy. If you go up from reverence, you know, the sublimest fear of the Lord, up to the third level of meaning. And Jesus said, I find you there, maxed out on reverence, and I would lead you up to recognition, realization, appreciation, and love. And eventually you'll get up to the sixth level of meaning and find that where L-O-V-E lives. So it's right there.
This development, they can just so predict what we're going to do, what we're going to think, that we're going to need the Urantia book to help us. We're such predictable people. Yeah.
But again, it's just the Urantia book in my lap is just a potential. You know, if I can't penetrate through my old wineskins, it's not going to be of any real use to me or mankind. I've got to put it in new wineskins. I've got to break out of my old worldview, my old framework. I can't interpret the word heart in the Urantia book as a synonym for feelings. I can't interpret the word spirit in the Urantia book as a synonym for feelings. I can't interpret the word personality in the book as a synonym for self or temperament or something. I have to somehow break free from all of the framework, in order to get to the substance that when I strike step with it, it produces this new dynamic living quality within me, in contrast to the relatively dead person I was before. There wouldn't be an emergency if we weren't all basically dead. I mean, our minds are basically dead. There is no truth in our minds. We're not really living, right? As the Revelators say. You've got to get to that truth. An aggrandizement of my old errors, because I seem to see them affirmed in the Revelation, is not what we need. It's not what I need. Okay, let's see if we can finish up this section here.
Hunger and love drove men together. Vanity and ghost fear held them together. But these emotions alone, without the influence of peace-promoting revelations, are unable to endure the strain of the suspicions and irritations of human inner associations. Without help from superhuman sources, the strain of society breaks down upon reaching certain limits. And these very influences of social mobilization, hunger, love, vanity, and fear conspire to plunge mankind into war and bloodshed.
All good things taken to extreme become bad. Over and over again, you've got that, happening in the book. So yet another way of appreciating that. You see them using the love as shorthand again. And again, he's speaking to why there's ever any revelation on a world, let alone specifically why this book is in my lap. We need it for what they're saying here. Why do we see these tensions building? Why is it harder and harder for Congress to accomplish anything, for instance? Right? These suspicions and irritations of human inner associations are growing and growing, are increasing and increasing and increasing, I should say. Right? Because that's what happens naturally without revelation. It's inescapable. There's a limit to how far these natural things can take it. Eventually, it has to become unnatural. It has to become artificial. It has to become personal. Right? Where the only way you go forward is responding positively to a negative stimulus. They're just, no matter how clever the system is, you just can't get something that, is effectively a positive stimulus so that there's progress. Right? You have to choose to progress. That's civilization, that choice. Going beyond the cattle prods, is what, like I said, we'll get to, of slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive, and the various kind of inevitability contrasts with those that cattle prod you forward. Eventually, you have to just choose. You can't go forward anymore because you're being pushed. You have to actually choose to take a step. No one can push you anymore. Not even God.
Come to think of it, wasn't the Beatitudes a study in negative inputs yielding positive outputs, happiness?
Right, and that's why, of course, the Revelators, use happy, are they?
Yeah.
right? Instead of like blessed. Because it's technically an unnatural thing. It's a religious thing. It's a positive response to a negative stimulus. All right. Yep. So, so again, you know, the why revelation, you know, what you're trying to get from this book. Okay.
The peace tendency of the human race is not a natural endowment. It is derived from the teachings of revealed religion, from the accumulated experience of the progressive races, but more especially from the teachings of Jesus, the Prince of Peace.
Okay, so again, it's not natural. I was just stressing that, so you've got that. At some point, it has to become an art form, a personal fact, an artificial. And just look at what's between the lines, that, but more especially from the teachings of Jesus, the Prince of Peace. You know, that fact that you didn't begin to really have much of a civilized peace phenomenon on the world until you had cultures that were choosing to predicate themselves on that Judeo-Christian heritage. I mean, again, what differentiates the foundations of the United States from others? How, they're reminding you of how important that is. How, when you don't have that Judeo-Christian predicate, don't expect peace to come flowing all over the world from those cultures. And so that's an interesting, see, little between the lines and the importance of that. You know, we're not talking about theocracies here, but if you separate God from man, you know, or from the human philosophy that comes from Christianity, from the New Testament, more precisely, you're not going to get very far, and you will begin to go backwards. So that's an interesting little reminder there too that they throw in. All right, now that next time we'll pick up on, you can see the evolution of the mores. We'll get into a little bit more about this socialized phenomenon, these issues of folkways, mores, laws. Understand that a little bit more. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.